AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show for your Friday. Good to be with you today. Matt, Patrick, David here. We'll have Brett stop on. Everyone's going to be here today. Patrick is starting us off. Hi, Patrick. How are you today, my friend?
Good, good. It's been a busy end of the week. I had a basketball game last night. I'm going to another basketball game tonight, and then I have two hockey games tomorrow to commentate.
So. What basketball game you got tonight?
Chaska's taking on Eastview.
That's not bad.
No, it should be a good game.
That's a good game. What do you think, since you brought it up, I wasn't planning on talking about this, they got the shot clock now.
I think it's a good institution. I, you know, I'm a little hesitant on some of these rule changes for high schoolers, but I think a shot clock is a good plan.
Well, and I think a lot of it had to do with the what was it a few years ago? There was one of the teams that took on Hopkins, I think it was, in the semifinals of the state championship. And they basically just, you know, very 1940s held the ball and, you know, and just bounced it, passed it around and, you know, held it as long as they could. And I think that was like a 5-4 game, something like that.
I don't remember that. I do remember one game some years ago, might have been the Blake Hoffarber year, because I think he had, you know, back-to-back years where he made a shot off his rear end, one with Hopkins, one with the Gophers.
Yeah.
And so I recall that game, they were coming down to the end, and it was tied with about a minute 15 left, and a team just held on to the ball for, you know, a minute and 40 seconds or something like that, and it started getting some boos coming down in the Target Center.
It doesn't do too good when all of a sudden, stop it! Give us some action! I'm all for it. I think that's college basketball, too. I mean, it will get the kids ready to play if they actually have the ability to play at the college level. It will get them to play. But it's only for varsity, for boys and girls, right?
Yes.
All right. There you go. Patrick is the guy I go to when I need to talk about stuff like that. We are going to, as my neighbor now has the Christmas dinosaur out, they have a young kid, so they've got the Christmas dinosaur in their front yard. Happy holidays, as Jesus called it. I think one of the three kings rode a dinosaur on, and I've heard, Stegosaurus maybe. Anywho, today I got the lights prepped. I'm taking Sven's advice from yesterday, where Sven said, yeah, you probably want to put your holiday lights up on Saturday. Doesn't look like the snow is going to come through. On Sunday, for sure, doesn't look like it's going to come through here. Looks like we're only going to get grazed on Tuesday now, too. Maybe an inch on Tuesday. So we'll have to see, but I'm getting ready to go with it. It is December. We're getting to the first weekend. It's time for me to get my holiday spirit on. I just can't do it, though, before this now. Are you one of those people that... You're not Thanksgiving Christmas, are you? You're not.
No.
No. I have to have a little bit of a break there. I'm still digesting food from Thanksgiving.
You might still have some leftovers. We're not done yet with those.
I just had to put some of the soup in the freezer because we have so much of it. I need to have that break. But now we're ready for it. I got my wife and the kids are out getting the tree right now. I pulled down my old style Christmas lights, the ones that look like Snoopy's doghouse. Remember when he does that in Charlie Brown Christmas?
Yeah.
Yeah, I got those. The ones that used to be the dancing bulbs that went down on Holidazzle and Nicollet Mall. Yeah. If you say it like that, everyone knows exactly what you're talking about. So I got those out. Those are industrial strength. These are ones I inherited from my dad. They actually have a fuse box on the light. I mean, that's a tough light bulb there. So I got those out. We're going to get everything up. The problem I've got is I've got a tree that's been growing. And now I cannot dangle a child without getting into some serious problems, probably. I cannot dangle a child from the top of the ladder to get to the top of the tree. And I guess I could hire one of these companies that comes in and does these things. But I think we need to actually have a serious injury in my household before my wife will allow me to consider that. So, I mean, I'm just stating a fact. I mean, I think we need to have someone wounded. And then, okay, let's get someone in here. So, but I got to try to figure out, I got to get all the lights up on the tree. I got to get that all done. It's time to look Christmassy, even though we don't have snow. So, I hope if you're heading north this weekend, And a lot of people, this is the time of year they start doing up there, going up there and trying to get some family time in. Call ahead to find out what you're driving into. Look ahead. Know what you're heading into, because it does sound like some areas up on the range especially could get up to 6+ inches of snow. That makes for some tough driving. So just be careful out there. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Coming up a little bit later on, Jeffrey Krames, author of the book The Joe Biden Way, he is going to be joining Brett, and they're going to have that little discussion coming up a little bit later on. But we'll start on off with the Minnesota coronavirus update for today. Friday's COVID update from the Minnesota Department of Health includes 5,685 newly reported cases and 62 newly reported deaths, including a teen between the ages of 15 and 19 from Beltrami County. I'll get back to that in a second. That brings the state's COVID-19 death toll to 9,616. Demographic information about the teenager who died has not been provided, but it marks the third Minnesota teenager to die of COVID-19 since the beginning of the pandemic. Through December 2nd, the number of people with COVID-19 hospitalized in Minnesota was 1,557. That's up from 1,549 reported yesterday. Of those hospitalized, 353 people are in intensive care. That's up from 345, and 1,203 are in non-ICU care, down from 1,204. So it's still a lot of people. The most ICU patients during the duration of the pandemic was 399 on December 1st of last year. Currently, only 19 staffed adult ICU beds available in the entire state, down from 24 on December 1st, and 5 pediatric ICU beds are available, which is down from 8 yesterday. Pediatric non-ICU beds are also strained, only 13 available statewide. Thanks, Republican districts of Minnesota, where you're not taking this seriously and most of these cases are coming from. It's sure appreciated that you're breaking our healthcare system. As of November 29th, the state reported that 3,655,697 people have received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. 3,373,236 people have completed the vaccine series. The state has administered 1,139,911 third dose booster shots. The total amount of people with coronavirus in the state of Minnesota, 926,931. The death of a teenager in Beltrami County announced on Friday by the Minnesota Department of Health marks the third teenager death from COVID-19, all of them happening within the past 3 months. Delta is not a joke, people. Delta is not a joke. In October, a teenager from Hennepin County died, followed by the death of a teen from Goodhue County in November. All three teenage deaths were individuals aged 15 to 19. The pandemic has also proved to be very hard on school-age kids, beginning with forcing schools to distance learn during the 2020-2021 school year, and now that the Delta variant impacting young people is more transmissible virus capable of producing more severe disease, namely among the unvaccinated. Kids age 5 and older are eligible to be vaccinated in Minnesota. Numerous school districts have announced longer upcoming winter breaks, not only to give students a staff longer break than more than a year and a half of stressful pandemic-related circumstances, but also to help prevent further spread of the disease during the ongoing surge affecting Minnesota. How the pandemic evolves with the arrival of Omicron variant remains to be seen, but early reports out of South Africa, where the variant was discovered, have revealed a significant increase in child hospitalizations, especially kids younger than 5 who are not eligible to be vaccinated. Perhaps the key metric favoring the U.S. and more specifically Minnesota is that only 42% of adults in South Africa are fully vaccinated. In Minnesota, 64.9% of people aged 5 and older are vaccinated. Health leaders remain confident the vaccines will continue to protect against severe illness and death from the Omicron variant, which has been the case so far in reinfection cases around the world, including the first case involving Omicron in Minnesota. We're delighted that the initial cases who have had vaccine breakthrough have been mild illnesses, said Chris Ayersman, director of the Infectious Diseases and Minnesota Department of Health. We can prevent infection in the first place, great, but ultimately our goal with vaccination is to limit hospitalizations, prevent death, and so far with limited data, that's what we've seen. So as a matter of fact, I did want to mention, Bring Me in the News has put out the chart that kind of breaks down the people who have passed away in per age group. And you know, it's lesser on the younger side. From 0 to 4 years, the entire pandemic, there have been 29,296 cases in kids 0 to 4 years old, but only one death. 5 to 9, 2. None for 10 to 14. 3 now, as we mentioned in the news there, 15 to 19-year-old. 20 to 24 is 8. 25 to 29, 17. 30 to 34 is coming in at 37. 35 to 39, 50. 40 to 44, 73. 45 to 49, 131. 50 to 54, 232. 55 to 59, 340. 60 to 64, 566. 65 to 69, 710. The 70 to 74 is 993. 57 to 70, 75 to 79 is 1,181. 80 to 84 is 1,491. 85 to 89 is 1,604, which is by far the largest group, by nearly 100 more than 80 to 84. 90 to 94 is 1,383. 95 to 99, 666. And 100 plus is 128 people have died. Here's what I want to, I kind of want to put forward. And this is, we have to shake ourselves out of this broken country that we're in right now, where you have people, and let me share with you a story, some of the social media posts that I perviewed today that were mildly disturbing. Now, we don't know much about Omicron. This is the South African variant that's starting to, now we have a case in Minnesota, and people are tracking it. But there have been reports that the people that are infected with Omicron, especially the person out in California and the person in Minnesota, had actually been vaccinated. And to my knowledge, the person in Minnesota had not only been vaccinated, but had gotten their booster shot, but still got the Omicron variant. Now, I have been consistent when I have said, I don't want you sick, I don't want you dead, and I don't want you bankrupt for the rest of your life. I don't. And I don't care if you have an R next to your name. I don't care if you're one of the most far-right Rs on the planet. I don't want you dead. I don't want you sick. I don't. I don't agree with you politically, but I don't want you ill will on you. The joy and glee that I read today from right-wing fools who feel as if Omicron is great because vaccinated people are getting sick is one of the most disturbing things I have seen in a while. People, these far-right loon balls who have been encouraged by Republicans to not get vaccinated and not wear masks and not socially distance, as much as they try to say, well, I didn't say I'm against vaccines. You guys have basically made your position known. You've downplayed the importance of vaccines. You've downplayed the importance of masks. You've downplayed the importance of social distancing. And message received, because the vast majority of the cases that are in the state of Minnesota and in this country are coming from Republican areas. Absolutely. And you guys now are so desperate to get some sort of win out of this, as you're sick, as the people that are following the Republicans' guidance are getting sick and dying, coming bankrupt, having long-term health care conditions. And now all of a sudden, you can cackle with glee because you think Omicron is going to go get those vaccinated people. Ha ha. Really? What the hell is wrong with you morons? Seriously. Did you get hit in the head? I'm dead serious. Did you get hit in the head? Are you on drugs? It should not be escape any of us that these are the same people who consider themselves to be Christians. Christians! And will tell you how proud of their Christian faith they are. Look at my 3-month display for Jesus' birth. And they're howling with laughter over the thought of vaccinated people getting Omicron. We need to get back to a point. I want to go back to the list here of the people. And I with all due respect to the Greatest Generation, and like I said, I've said this from the get-go, you guys did not deserve, when Republicans first came out and said, they're old, let them die. I mean, dear Lord, what in the hell is wrong with you people? the Greatest Generation didn't deserve to go out like this, and those numbers are pretty harsh. I'm not trying to downplay those, but I want to go back and let's just look at, okay, here we go, 35 to 39 years old, 50 people. 50 people, 35 to 39 years old, have died of COVID. 50. 50. Now, at the beginning of this whole thing, if I were to tell you, hey, if we don't do this, we're going to have 50 people aged 35 to 39 in the state of Minnesota alone dead. 50. Those people, if we don't do something before Trump, people would have been alarmed by that and said, okay, what do we have to do? Let's band together. Yes, we disagree politically on a lot of things, but we can also band together for the betterment of this country. We used to be that country. And today, I'll bring up 50 people, 35 to 39. The first thing out of Righto's mouths are, most of those people didn't die. They died of gout. They didn't die of COVID. They had gout. So if they died of COVID, they still died of gout first. And that is kind of the way these people are. And now they're giddy with excitement over the thought that Omicron might actually be dangerous to people who are vaccinated. Shame on you. Shame on all of you. You fake Christians, because you're not. I mean, if you truly think you're a Christian, I want you to go to your church and say, is it all right for me to cheer and laugh at the idea of vaccinated people getting sick? Because I'm going to pretty sure, I'm going to go out on a limb here that most religious leaders are going to say, what? No, that's not a good thing to cheer for. You sit there and you act as if you've got piety. The reality is you're some of the most unreligious, unchristian human beings that's ever walked the earth. And you are doing this because your blood allegiance to Trump overrides everything else, even your own health, your own children's health, your own wife's health or husband's health, your own safety, your own house, your job, all these things. They don't matter to you, only owning the libs. And it's ruined you. It's ruined you to the core. Because if you're sitting there and happy or gleeful or excited in any way about the fact that here's another variant that could possibly kill people, but as long as it's the people I want to be killed, that's good. There is something mentally wrong with you. And you need psychological help immediately. Immediately. I'm consistent with my point of view, which, by the way, happens to be the Christian point of view. I don't want you dead, I don't want you sick, and I don't want you bankrupt for the rest of your life because of COVID. Anything else really is just it's an abomination to our society. Anything else is an abomination to our freaking society. Get vaccinated. Wear a mask. Think about your fellow man. Because we used to in this country. It wasn't just a bunch of selfish, greedy, self-centered jackasses. We used to care about each other. And my God, it's about time we remember that. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. The Progressive Voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. Oh, and just in time for my plea for more civility and trying to get us back to this. Prior Lake High School says it's now investigating another racist video posted to social media involving one of its students and a child from another school district. Wow. Yeah, your policy sure seems great down there. Principal Dr. John Bezek, in a letter sent to the high school staff and families today, wrote the video, which he described in the message as racist, was reported to the administration this week. As soon as the video was brought to the attention, we launched an investigation. We took swift and appropriate actions with the students involved. Bezek continued, adding, Prior Lake Savage area schools will not tolerate racism or hate speech. We believe everyone in our schools need to be accountable for their words and actions. Therefore, we will continue to take action when we hear racial slurs or hate speech or when an incident is brought to our attention. This comes less than a month after the emergence of the racist TikTok video that made national headlines. In that video posted November 8th, a female student on screen and another off screen repeatedly utter racial slurs and suggested a student of color should take their own life, all while laughing. Police launched an investigation and said it's possible more than one student could face criminal charges. The district superintendent, Terry Stalock, said that the student seen in the video is no longer enrolled in the district. Well, that solved that problem, huh? Yeah. The first video was directed towards a 14-year-old Naya Sinjin, who became forward publicly after the support of her family. Her sister, Elizabeth Sinjin, spoke at the school board meeting just before Thanksgiving to address the racism in the district. The contents of the social media video reported this week were not detailed in the principal's letter. The message also doesn't say when this newest video was posted. Bezik noted the school met with students this week to take active steps to promote conversations about the culture of our school and help ensure the safe learning environment, and promised to support and listen to students as they work to drive change in this school. He also encouraged people to use the confidential online reporting system to make them aware of dangerous or potentially harmful situations. Thank you for those who reported the video to us. That's the case. You got a problem down there, Prior Lake. I'm saying, you got a problem down there, because this is, you are at the point where you are having to instruct your students, hey, just being openly racist and crazy like that is not acceptable. It's not like there is a question here was it racist, or, you know, someone said something in the hallway that was misinterpreted or something like this, and so you're having a sit down with both students. It's nothing like this. You've got people who basically are kids who are looking to earn their sheet cred for the next, you know, rally, I guess. Grand Wizard Junior there. That basically don't seem to have the basic common sense that, no, that's wrong. And the fact that you actually had this happen a second time. Now, once again, I want to be careful here, because it's not clear from the story whether or not that video actually was made prior to the other two idiots who made the other video. Yeah, they're morons. And you can open and roll into any different district you want to, but dear Lord. What the hell's wrong with you and your kids? What's wrong with your kids, man? That's the parents. It's the parents. Does it surprise me that we have another one? No, it doesn't. It doesn't. I mean, I brought this up yesterday with the Hastings story, where this private Facebook group outed an 8-year-old child in the district and tormented the child as a way to try to win the election. And there are 3 school board members who are incoming who may or may not have been part of that Facebook group, which, want to make sure we understand that there are 3 people who potentially could be representing the school district after they themselves attacked a child in said school district and use their attack against that child to basically win. Sweet Lord. Wow. If they were part of that Facebook group, they are horrible human beings. And like I said, I'm not saying people should do this, but I don't think I'd be too upset at all if people were going to the school board meetings and screaming shame at those 3 people at every time there was a public hearing, because they need to understand that that was not acceptable if they were part of that Facebook group, which kind of sounds like I've heard some rumors that they are. I don't know for sure. We'll have to find out. That is not a one-time deal. That is in Hastings, that is a group of parents that basically are just horrible human beings in the city of Hastings banding together and to make their hatred as ugly as possible. That's all that is. Well, in Prior Lake, what do you got going on over there? I mean, for goodness sakes, I can tell you right now, I've had talks with my kids. I said, you know, you want to be, and I mean, it's not just racism. I mean, there's a lot of things kids put up online on TikTok and stuff like this. And he's like, you need to be careful what you put out there, because once it's out there, it's out there. And I've always raised my kids that say, we're not better than anyone else. For God's sakes, no. What race am I part of? The human race. That's what race I'm part of. And that we all have our story. We all have our journey. We all have our perspective. And we should respect them all. So maybe I've done a good job raising my kids not being, you know, Ava Braun Jr. or anything like that. But at the same time, it's just disturbing to me that here you have this case and the shame that this brought to the Prior Lake School District. The shame! Only to have someone kid saying, well, let me up to bat. I mean, my God. You got problems, man. You got problems. That's not me. That's you. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. Progressive Voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. So I want to touch on something that shockingly I have been talking about for years. Years and years and years and years. We've had arguments. We've had fights. We've had these discussions in regards to school start times. Now, the reason I'm bringing this up is our kids' school, my kids are in the Hopkins School District. They have announced that starting next year, they're going to switch around start times. And so the younger kids are going to start school earlier. The older kids are going to start school later. And the current thing right now is that the kids generally, I think, start school somewhere around 7:40 in the morning. If you're on the buses, I mean, Hopkins is a big district. So if you're on the buses, you have to sometimes be out there by 7 o'clock in the morning. So you're up, you know, depending on the student, 6 o'clock, which means that if you want to get the prescribed amount of sleep per day, that you need to be going to bed around 10 o'clock or so. And the argument is, and one of the things that you'll hear in regards to the argument is that if you allow kids to sleep more, that they'll be better students, they'll get better night's sleep, and growing brains. And as I've said, I don't really have a problem with any of that. But my mentality has always been, well, the kids need to go to bed earlier then. And I understand, and when I bring this up, When I say, well, maybe the child should go to bed instead of at midnight, go to bed at 10. I will hear stories from the individual who will sit and say something to the effect of, well, this child is out working 70 hours a week and trying to go to school. And I'm like, well, okay, first of all, that's not true. That's not happening. I'm not saying that there aren't some kids, my kids as well, have pulled shifts after work from, say, 5 to 9 o'clock at night. And depending on when they get their homework done, as a matter of fact, I will say this. I mean, some of the schools actually make sure that there's time in every kid's school day to get some homework done while they're in school, which is great, I think. But it's not an everyday sort of situation. I don't know of, you know, kids that basically are, you know, working in the coal mines, you know, 12 hours a day and trying to go to school. I mean, that's just not a, you know, as much as people try to make it seem like that's the norm, that's not the norm. And the reality is from my experience and from seeing a lot of parents and a lot of kids from a lot of different age groups, The kids that seem to have the hardest time are just the ones where mom and dad don't look at them and say, hey, it's 10 o'clock, go to bed. And the first thing that usually when I get the story in regards to the, oh, well, they're working. This is working. It's too, you, blah, 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 blah. I'll say, well, your kid's not working. Your kid's only working a few hours. I know that. It's not that. I mean, why can't they get everything done? And it's like, well, they got sports and stuff. Okay, well, all right. They get done with school at 2:30, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. They have from then 7 hours. And so I don't think they're training for the Olympic squad. So I don't think that that's a 7-hour training session. I know that they're not working 7 hours in that day. It's just they got to do better time management, get the work done, and get to sleep. And then the next thing you hear is, well, I don't want to be that parent. And if I may say, and I'm not a parenting expert, I'm not. But if I may say, tough. That's the job you signed up for. And so here we are, and my kid's school is going to switch things around, and the school is going to start later. And there have been some studies out there. As a matter of fact, I've read some studies where they've said that they haven't found a discernible improvement in the grades, which, okay, but they do say that there is definitely an improvement in the sleeping. The physical and mental health benefits of getting a good night's sleep are indisputable, with less clear as whether starting school later in the morning will prompt kids to sleep more and consequently learn more during the school day. Fewer studies have looked at academic achievement after the later morning bell. Some have found improved student performance. Some haven't. A new study from Minnesota, and this is an earlier study from this year, from April of this year. A new study in Minnesota documented what happened to 18,000 students in grades 5 through 11 after four school districts postponed the start of their school day by 20 to 65 minutes. Student grades increased a little, raising students' grade point averages by an extra 0.1 points on average, basically equivalent going from a B average at 3.1 to a B average at 3.2. But, you know, fair is fair. That is a slight increase. Once again, though, there are studies that have shown that there hasn't been any academic increase. Despite concerns kids would stay up later if the school night started later in the morning, many students reported sleeping more after the switch to start times. Students were 16% more likely to meet the recommended hours of sleep, which is 9 or more hours of students in grades 5 through 8 and at least 8 hours for students grades 9 through 11. Research at the University of Minnesota and the Bloomington, Minnesota Public Schools characterized the academic benefits as small, but the sleep increases as large. The study was instigated by the school district of Bloomington, home of the Mall America and headquarters of the various businesses, because it had to be considering whether to shift its school to a later start time, wanted to have more data to inform the decision. Local officials pressed the snooze button on the sleep debate during the COVID pandemic, but the researchers presented their study. The changes in school start time have a significant effect on the amount of sleep and reported grade point average of students. Well, not as significant, it's 0.1, but it is increased, at least in this study. I'm going to go back to my original statement about this. By shifting kids to a later start time, I don't know what we're doing here, but it feels to me, considering the world, even during this pandemic, operates on a workday starting at 7:30, 8 o'clock, 8:30, 9 o'clock, needless to say, early in the morning. And that is even with the pandemic, even with remote work and all that stuff, that still most people are going into the office, checking in, doing their work on the same timeline. The question I have, and you go to colleges, they have early start times of classes. My concern is this: if you want to increase sleep, I mean, you want to encourage parents to kind of tell their kids, go to sleep. You can do that without shifting the school day around. This only almost seems like, to a point, policy to make parents look cooler than they are. And I really do feel this way. I honestly do. And I know that there are some people that will violently disagree with me. Fine, whatever. But the reality is, you can go to sleep earlier in the evening and get the same amount of sleep. You don't have to undermine and disrupt the current schedule that they have. And it's a shame that some parents out there don't want to tell their kid to go to sleep, but yeah, that's the case. Go to sleep. And are there a handful of people, and I do mean a handful of people, where there might be extenuating circumstances? Sure. But those should not be the standard we change everything else for. There's always a few outliers to any kind of formula. So I don't know if that's necessarily the case. But what happens when these high school kids that basically have now been told, make sure you don't have to go to bed till you know, 11, you don't have to be to school till 9, you can still get a decent night's sleep there. What happens when they have their first school class at college at 7 a.m.? Are the parents going to sit there and say, oh, okay, now you got to get up early? Or are they going to say, well, this isn't fair for me. I don't like getting up before 8 o'clock. And my gut feeling is eventually we're going to have colleges start saying, well, we're going to move most of our classes to later in the day to accommodate. I don't know. I don't know what you're accommodating there. Because like I said, sleep is a funny thing. You can go to sleep at 9 o'clock and sleep until 6. You get 9 hours of sleep. Some people are like, well, that's early. Well, but you can still do it, right? And they'll look at you like, it's impossible to do that. No, it's not. It just isn't. It's just you don't want to do it. And there's the difference. You don't want to do this. And so now the school district has to change because you just don't want to do that. And what happens when all of a sudden these kids graduate college and they're not used to working, getting up at 7 a.m. for a job, and all of a sudden they take their college degree, chuck it to the side, and end up working as a bartender? Nothing wrong with working as a bartender, but if you got a $200,000 college degree and you're deciding basically I'm just going to work as a waiter or waitress or a bartender, well, then, you know, you could have saved the $200,000 because it's just too early in the day to get up and go into the office. What value have you gotten there? I think it's important. I mean, I've talked to a lot of medical professionals. It's important that kids get a full night's sleep. My kids generally are in bed by 10 o'clock. Yeah, they are. I've always set a standard. There are some nights where they're up a little later. But, I mean, it's very rare. And they themselves know that if they're not getting enough sleep, that they're basically kind of worthless the next day. It's interesting, this report. I'm glad more kids are getting sleep because that was also my big concern, and I've said this before, and it sounds like, to a point, I was wrong on this, that some of these kids will just then stay up until, if they're going to bed at 1 o'clock, now they'll just stay up till 3 o'clock. Doesn't sound like that's happening. Not saying it's not happening in some capacity, but it's not happening overall, and most kids are getting more sleep. But I just think that there isn't anything wrong with accountability, people. There isn't anything wrong with looking at a child and saying to them, go to sleep. There isn't anything wrong with that. And I don't know. It's like I said, I look at something like this and I say to myself, you know, this almost seems like policy to make ourselves feel like we're being progressive when we could solve this problem by saying, hey, parents, by the way, make sure your kids are trying to get to bed by 10 o'clock because that would be a good 8 hours of sleep. And instead, I think you changing up the entire system, I don't know if that's a tremendous amount of value. I just don't. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. You're more than welcome to berate me if you so desire on this one. We'll take a break. Come on back. The Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. Two business updates here for you. First of all, the University of Minnesota Carlson School of Management, Dean Sri Zahir, apologized for comments she made about COVID-19 pandemic to staff during a meeting when she told them to chill out and get over it, and said that staff who wanted to continue to work remotely missed their afternoon naps and watching Bold and the Beautiful at noon. Is the Bold and the Beautiful on at noon? I can't believe any soap opera is still on the air. Afternoon naps and watching Bold and Beautiful. This is the head of the University of Minnesota Carlson School of Management telling this. She apologized for the comments, but wow! Is that the mentality of managers during a pandemic, that all these people are just slackers because they're concerned? Come on. You're apologizing because this got found out, but yeah. General Mills is warning wholesale buyers about an impending price increase that will most certainly be passed on to shoppers. That's according to a recent CNN business report, which saw copies of letters the Minnesota-based company sent to retailers. The letter explained that come mid-January 2022, prices on many of its products would go up by as much as 20%. That includes products across many of its known brands, including Betty Crocker, Annie's Progresso, Pillsbury, Yoplait, and more. The company owns an astonishing number of well-known brands. In fact, General Mills has been described as one of the 10 companies that control everything you buy because of their breadth. Kelsey Romhilt, a General Mills spokesperson, told Bring Me the News in a written statement that the inflationary environment has led to higher prices for commodities, logistics, and other costs in the supply chain, while the company thinks it can save about 4% of the cost of goods with internal productivity changes. Inflation is so high right now that the productivity alone won't solve it. The statement continued, given the level of inflation and other supply chain costs that we forecast the fiscal year, we will be using all the tools in our pricing toolkit, including taking list price increases where we need across our portfolio. The price increases would add further strain to the families who have already been hit by rising consumer prices. The most recent data shows wages in Minnesota are up 6.3% compared to a year earlier. That's a faster rise than the national average of 5.1%. But during that same time, the cost of goods went up about 6.2% overall. The cost of cereals and baking products have gone up 3.5% in the past 12 months, according to the Bureau of Labor and Consumer Prices. That's not a sharp increase as many meat, fish, and egg producers, but still significant. Dairy prices were up 1.8% over the 12-month period as well. There's my first problem with this story. You're saying you're going to increase the price of foods up to 20%. Well, there's 3.5%. So that would seem to me you're basically gouging the crap out of the consumer. That's 1.8% for the dairy stuff. Well, that means what the heck is the other 18.2% for? Okay, factoring in maybe some wage increases or something like this, you're still well below the 20% increase in costs you're screaming about. And I don't know, I mean, it's meat, fish, and egg products have gone up, but I know they haven't gone up 20% per se. I don't believe so. But let's take a look at how General Mills is doing. For its 2021 fiscal year, the company reported net sales of $18.1 billion, a 3% increase over the prior year, as well as operating profit of $3.1 billion, up from 6% the previous year. That's up, down from 6%. I don't know. It's up 6%. 6% of $3.1 billion is up 6% from the previous year. They had a great year. So here's what, and we should mention the CEO, Jeffrey Hammerang, meanwhile, had a base salary of $1.25 million, another $5.25 million in stock awards with a total compensation for the year of $15.57 million. The 2021 compensation for group president Jonathan Nudi totaled just under $5.65 million, while CFO Kofi Bruce received just under $3.45 million. Boy, I hope they have enough money when it comes to the 20% increases of their own products. Oh, oh wait, they get a discount? Oh, all right. They probably get it at cost? Oh, okay. I'm going to guess. They probably have an employee store over there. Here's my problem. We're going to have a lot of people that are screaming. It's like, Joe Biden, look at him, you're raising the prices. No, this is, in case you missed it, they made $3.1 billion last year in profit. Yeah, they did. So this price increase isn't about making it. This price increase is to continue the obscene CEO corporate bonus pay structure. That seems to be what's going on here. Because we went through the price of dairy has increased, what was it, 1.8%. The cost of cereals and bakery products have gone up 3.5%. Well, that's not 20%, and that's what you say. You're going to increase costs up to 20%. So what are they doing? Well, they want to make sure their profit margins are big enough. Because reminder, the problem we have, and one of the biggest problems we have in our country right now, is there are too many people that treat Wall Street like it's a Vegas roulette table. and they want to go on out there and they want to gamble on what a stock price is going to do. And so companies can be wildly successful, but because the experts, the quote-unquote experts, said they should be making 15 cents per share as opposed to 14 cents per share as they did, well, then they're a major failure. The company needs to die. The entire executive staff needs to be fired. And the reality is that this is, we have people that are gambling on businesses that is what dictates cost. So the company has got to go on out there and make it look like they're making even more money than the 6% increase they had last year. Or else Wall Street insiders are going to think that we're not successful. You guys could take a pay cut. You guys could, I don't know, sacrifice maybe $1 billion, maybe $2 billion in profits. Still have a lot of profit money too, and not gouge the consumer. Just saying, that's at least from the numbers I'm seeing in this story. And if they're wrong, they're wrong. But you could do it that way. Instead, you're just going to raise it up, make sure you get your 15th jet ski or you get your 7th vacation home, while the rest of us have to shell out more money. Oh, I still can't wait for the age of greed to die in this country, you know? I sure can't. Hour two of the show, that's coming up next. Minnesota. There you go. A little loud there. It is the Matt McNeil Show. Hour two on your Friday, 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. If that was loud for you, no, trust me, that was loud for me. David, how are you, my friend? We haven't seen you in a while.
I'm doing well, Matt.
All right, good, good. Are you a person who rides on the bus at all in the city of Minneapolis, St. Paul?
Well, no, not really.
Have you seen, I have not seen these because I haven't, I've taken buses to like State Fair and stuff. And occasionally, like if I was going to go downtown and I didn't want to deal with parking for a big event, I would basically jump on a bus. Have you seen these slanted benches?
I've seen them. I have not sat on one yet.
Well, no one likes them apparently. Now, first of all, can I ask this?
Yes.
Was it really that big of a problem that homeless people were lying on a bench?
Well, I can't see that as being a big problem.
I've been downtown a lot, and I've taken buses downtown. I mean, they're sure occasionally there's someone on a bench sleeping, but it's not all the time, and it's not every bench. I mean, this seems like a lot of money to solve a problem which is really not a huge problem in my mind. I mean, I get it. Some predominantly tertiary suburban white people looking like, look at the homeless person. Homelessness is out of control of the city. No, but I'm like, I've been downtown. I've seen a few people at times, but not a lot. So the idea of ripping out all the old benches and putting in these slanted benches, and that's exactly what they are. They're, folks, if it's a bench that's in an angle. So if you sit on it, you'll slide off if you lift up your feet. You're going down. Slanted public transit benches by design aren't comfortable for anyone. This is according to Racket. Additionally, as revealed by a locally viral tweet, many Twin Cityans consider the slanted benches in several Metro transit stops punitive and dehumanizing to unhoused populations, which I can't disagree with.
Well, you know, I have to say, the few buses that I have ridden, like you said, to the fair, or if I'm going downtown to a Twins game or something like that, you get some bus drivers that are better at hitting potholes than others.
So, no, these are on the benches. These are on the part. This not on the bus.
You're talking about
the bus stop.
The waiting.
Yeah, the bus stop, yeah.
Okay, the bus stop,
it's
yeah.
It's not like it's on an airplane where you have a pole you're holding on to like you're in a subway car. Okay. Oh, my God. You're dangling sideways as you go into land. They actually did that. That was like Ryanair over in Europe.
Okay.
They did it where you basically had to stand and hold. You strapped yourself to a pole. And that was their cheap fare. And you could fly somewhere for like $25.
I did hear about that.
But you were standing strapped to a pole.
Yeah, that was going a bit too far.
Good luck with that. No, this is... it would be a riot to get a bus of slanted seats and, all right, kids, let's go.
As you say, hit a bump, slide right down to the floor.
We're going to reenact that whole scene from Shang-Chi. Okay, everybody, get ready. No knife guy, though, all right?
Yeah, that would be one for the Fail Army channel, no doubt.
They're also a drag for young and tired populations with mobility issues, which is a very legitimate point.
Well, exactly.
Not to mention populations who simply prefer a comfortable seat. The Metro Transit spokesperson Howie Padilla is aware that riders hate the slanted benches. They've implemented as the Green Line was developed as early as the 2010s, he says, and their lack of popularity became quickly apparent. What we found is that the lean bars certainly aren't preferable to regular benches, so we switched to these over. 38 slanted benches were swapped out for standard ones in 2019, Padilla says. To his knowledge, slanted ones only remain in 3 St. Paul light rail stops, Robert Street, Western, and Victoria. Where the anti-homelessness concerns, it happens when you have the last door open. None of us like that. I will say we want people experiencing homelessness to have the services and safest places they need. And as I'm not saying that this is an alternative, and I agree with him. This is not the alternative. This is not how you deal with homelessness. It's just make sure we have benches that are comfortable. You know, it's a much larger problem. But at the same time, okay, we're gonna have a slope like the big slide at the state fair. All right, just hopefully don't lift your. What happens if it's icy out? Yep, off you go. Launching. The benches are an example of, quote, hostile architecture, a method of design that impedes the use of public spaces, especially for unhoused or vulnerable populations who have nowhere else to rest. Think vertical bolts surrounding apartment complexes, boulders piled around roadside homeless encampments, and of course, annoying benches. I would say the one that I've noticed is I've seen some communities to stop people panhandling at the corners will put down something that's kind of like an antique gothic, you know, spiky thing where you can't stand on it. And they basically take this entire corner area anywhere near the street and they basically turn it into this, you know, spiky area, which concerns me because it's like if I accidentally go off the road, I'm taking out 2 tires at least, you know, just trying to swerve back onto that.
You know, that also sounds like a pedestrian killer, to be honest.
Nana was impaled over at the intersection. Oh, no.
Say, slip on some ice and, you know.
Down you go. No, I understand people don't like homelessness. I understand people don't like panhandlers. But I think that, you know, spending thousands, if not, you know, when you look at the scale of this, millions of dollars to basically put in horrible options that basically, A, no one likes, and B, seems pretty punitive for people who are down on, down and out. I agree. I think it's time for you to get rid of them. One other quick story I wanted to mention here, because obviously we had that shooting in Michigan, and this is an odd thing. I'm kind of surprised by this, that the parents. The Michigan authorities, they are searching for the 2 parents charged with the involuntary manslaughter in the high school shooting. Jennifer and James Crumbly are the parents of Ethan Crumbly, who is charged with murder and terrorism in the deaths of 4 students at Oxford High School on Tuesday. Now, as you heard in the news, this kid was not, clearly was having some serious mental issues, and it sounds like the parents were not taking it seriously and allowed him to get access to a gun, which was ended up using in the shooting of 4 innocent people. Crumbly's parents were charged Friday. A prosecutor says they gave their son access to a gun and didn't intervene despite problems in the school day. Oakland County Sheriff Mike Bouchard says the attorney for the Crumblys hasn't been able to reach them. Wow. 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 And this was also, if you haven't seen the report, what was it, Jennifer Crumbly, back in 2016, sent a love letter, for lack of a better way to say it, to Trump after the election, you know, talking about how much she was so happy that he was president because he was going to preserve everyone's Second Amendment rights. I don't know, man. I'm wondering if these parents are these gun kooks who feel as if no, the gun's the most important thing. So the heck with the dead bodies. You know, their kid's right to carry the gun was more important than anything else. I don't know. There seems to be some evidence that might be the case. We'll have to see. I don't know. That was earlier today. It did sound like they still have not turned themselves in at this point. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205 is the phone number. Brett, not here today. Usually we have him join us, but he's got things he's got to do. Yeah, whatever. He had the opportunity today to talk with Jeffrey Krames. He's the author of the book, Joe Biden Way. He sat down with him earlier today. Here is that interview right here on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson with you here on a Friday afternoon. Right now, we're joined by Jeffrey Krames. He's a leadership expert and has spent decades in business book publishing. He is the author of 9 leadership books, several of which were national and international bestsellers. And his most recent work is called The Joe Biden Way, How to Become a Bold and Empathetic Leader. In this book, Krames sets out 7 lessons in inspiring leadership that have helped President Biden carry his powerful message to the White House and deliver it to hundreds of millions of people. Jeffrey, thanks so much for joining me on the show today. Really appreciate it.
No, it's an honor, Brett. Anything for a fellow Midwesterner.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So what inspired you to write this book?
Well, as you pointed out, I do write leadership books, and most of the leadership books I've written have been about people from the world of business. You know, people like the former CEO of GE, Jack Welch. But my last book in 2015 was a book about humility and Pope Francis. And from the campaign of 2020, I saw Joe Biden as a singular figure. I saw him as someone able to use and wield empathy, not only in a time when America certainly needed empathy from its leader during a global pandemic and racial strife and problems with the Republican Party in search of an identity. And I was inspired by Joe Biden. And the day before he took the oath of office on the 20th of January of this year, I woke up one morning and I said, this is your next book. This is going to be your next book. I have to do a book on Joe Biden because he's inspired me out of his selflessness, out of a tragic life that he has lived, you know, with all of the terrible things he had to endure from losing his wife and daughter when in 1972 around Christmas. I mean, losing his son to brain cancer. He just struck me as this wonderful old school figure with great newfangled ideas. And so I had to do it.
Well, one of the areas you talk about with Biden is the fact that he's a very empathetic person. And I want to dive into that a little bit more about how empathy can play a role in effective leadership, because especially when we think about politics, we oftentimes think we need a strong, effective leader or a real strong man, when really empathy can also be a way that you can show effective leadership. Talk a little bit more about that.
Well, yeah, it's a wonderful point. You know, actually, even in the early going of the book, I point out an extensive study that was done that actually proved, in a way, that empathy could play an outsized role in determining a leader's success. And when others have asked me, you know, and have asked others who they see Biden compared to in history, many people say FDR, and what FDR accomplished was just, of course, immense importance to the world in many spheres, including the creation of the Social Security Act of 1935, which gave us our great social safety net in which Joe Biden is trying to enlarge. But back in the 1930s, when the economy was far, far worse than it is today, Joe Biden has just sort of has been the man for the right moment to tell everyone he feels their pain during this global pandemic, and here's what we're going to do to get out of it. And, I mean, he's just acted. Leadership is about action, but when you're a president, it's about words, but chiefly it's about actions. So when he came into office, there had only been 50,000 shots administered. The vaccines were relatively new, of course, under the previous administration. But now, why? I think, we're talking about a half a billion shots in arms now. He got 75% of people over 65 years of old vaccinated within just two and a half, three months. I mean, he's been a man of action when we really needed it. But what's been also so interesting, Brett, is that he doesn't really get a lot of credit for what he's done. And I'm not just talking about COVID. I'm talking about now if we could shift to his domestic agenda. Mm-hmm. I mean, people are hurting, and he's trying in basically three bills, two of which now have been made into law. The third, which the Build Back Better plan that people talk about, has passed the House. And I think he's trying to get this entire domestic agenda passed in one fell swoop because he feels people's pain. And when I say people's, I mean people of lower and middle class, and particularly people of color. Because when things go bad, it's often people of color and the least fortunate amongst us who take it on the chin. And I think he's trying to level the playing field, and he understands that his time could be limited because of the midterm elections, where 70% of the time the controlling party loses one of both chambers of Congress. So he's trying to get everything done in three bills, and he's almost there. And yet people forgot about the first bill, which was $1.9 trillion. That was the COVID Relief Act, the jobs plan. Then there was the $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill, the biggest investment in infrastructure in the history of our country. And now it's this latest sort of the social infrastructure part of the bill, where he's trying to help people sort of dig out of the hole that COVID has put so many people in. So I just think he's the right man at the right time.
I want to expand on something you were saying, too. And by the way, backing up to what you said, how Biden oftentimes doesn't get enough credit. Yeah, I think that's about the understatement of the year, that's for sure. But to talk a little bit more about what Biden has been able to accomplish and still what he's trying to do when he does have unified Congress with Democrats in control of the House and the Senate. You talk a little bit in your book about how it's important to set a single priority and then focus on it with laser precision. And I know that's difficult to do in today's environment when everyone wants things to happen right now and right away. And that does definitely, I think, pose a challenge for a leader when things do move a little bit slower than people would like. But I think, as you write, it's important to keep that laser focus on a single priority.
Yeah, he has maintained a remarkable focus. And, part of the book calls on business thinkers and leaders and geniuses, people like Peter Drucker, who is the father of modern management. I think I was the last person to ever interview him in 2003. He died in 2005. So I do bring in other business leaders into it. And he has to maintain his focus because he has learned through experience. And Malcolm Gladwell, the author of Outliers, who I call upon, and another author who wrote a similar book, he is called upon his experience each and every time. And his experience tells him this. If he allows himself to ever lose the focus, whatever his strategy he sets out, that $1.2 trillion infrastructure package, he really wanted that passed and saw a way to do it on a bipartisan basis. Mitch McConnell voted for it, 69 senators. That's never happened. That didn't happen during the Trump administration. Didn't happen. Almost never happens, especially today. But he got it done. So he has to stay focused. And to some extent, it's a strength, and it's a great strength of his, because he just can't do everything. I mean, today I just saw on the news, actually early in the week, there was a school shooting. And, I know he wants to get things done on guns, and he wants to get things done that'll on voting, because thought so much of our democracy seems to be sort of more in jeopardy than any other time in our lifetime. But he knows he can't get it all done because he's basically, while he controls, you know, the executive as the president and both chambers of Congress, he knows it's basically 50-50. I mean, it's exactly 50-50 in the Senate with Vice President Harris breaking that tie. And it's almost 50-50% to each side in the House. It's, they got a cushion of 3, 4, 5 people. You know, people like Lyndon Baines Johnson's great, who accomplished the Great Society, and FDR, they had amazing numbers of Democrats in the chambers of Congress. I mean, like more, like 100-seat margin for FDR, I think, at one point. So, you know, Biden doesn't have that at all. So his degree of difficulty in trying to get anything passed, I mean, just anything, is immensely more difficult in the age where 70%+ of the opposing party, which we need, doesn't believe that Mr. Biden is the fairly elected president. I mean, nothing like that's ever happened in our lifetime. Not Nixon. Not. I mean, I don't know when you have to go back to in our country, Brett, to see the last time where truth, or actually lies, have been weaponized to this extent.
Yeah, you have to go back, I think, way back in time, probably into the 19th century when Andrew Jackson was elected, to find that sort of thing that we're seeing now, where, yeah, we're having disputed results of legitimate elections.
Yeah,
definitely.
I agree with you. Yeah. I mean, you have to go back to the Civil War, right? I mean, but what's amazing is that no matter how disgraced the 45th president, Mr. Trump, has been with, you know, he was impeached twice. And yet people still follow him. I mean, he's in exile in Florida, but he just seems like he's in the wings, like a puppet master pulling the strings. And the Republican Party just seems to stand for nothing except obstruction and more of a white country. It is certainly the Democratic Party that does a much better job of at least trying to help people of color, you know, maintain their ability to vote and have a level playing field. It's not the other side. The other side usually gives the money to the top 5%. They make it harder to vote in country in states like in the South and the Rust Belt. I mean, it's incredible what's going on in the country. But yet, going back to our original discussion, Mr. Biden can't do it all. He has to choose. And basically, during the 2020 campaign, as I state in the book, he had a conversation with Bernie Sanders and told Senator Sanders that he wanted to be the most progressive president since FDR. And that's been his goal. So he has sided with the progressives in the House, with the AOC, the squad, because that's where the numbers are. They have almost 100 members who are members of the Progressive Caucus. And that's where his heart is. He wants to be a transformational president, even though he said he wants to be a transitional one. I think he wants to be a transformational one. And he's close to it. I mean, if he gets this third bill passed, that's $5 trillion. I remember when $1 billion was a lot of money. But $5 trillion, that's 5 times 1,000 billion. I mean, it's just incredible. And people of color and people of our middle classes, our lower classes, are going to feel it the most. So I think what he's trying to do is of immense importance. And I don't think he's going to get sidetracked until he gets it done.
We're speaking with author Jeffrey Krames about his new book, How to Become a Bold and Empathetic Leader, talking about Joe Biden. Again, the title is The Joe Biden Way, How to Become a Bold and Empathetic Leader. And Jeffrey, final few questions for you. And what are you hoping people take away from reading this book, especially those who might be in positions of leadership, whether it's in business, politics, or even, you know, in their local government? What are you hoping people take away from reading this book?
Well, thank you for that question, Brett. I want people to understand Joe Biden. First of all, you know, he was, when he was 17, 18, 19, he and his family used to listen to FDR speeches on the radio. And he, of course, John F. Kennedy, was the only Catholic and the first Catholic president. Now we have Joe Biden. So I want people to understand his Catholic roots, his Catholic upbringing, about sort of what informed him and why he has set out to accomplish such immense things for people who can't do it for themselves. The second thing is, though, is step by step, I show people how he got each of these things done. And they used to sort of joke about this in the previous administration about, is he playing three-dimensional chess? Let me tell you something. Joe Biden knows how to play three-dimensional chess. For those who say he might have lost his step, he's not as smart as he was, I don't agree with that. Yes, he moves a little slower, but I don't believe his brain does. He reads everything, and that's in here too. So basically, if you want to know who Joe Biden is, what motivates him, and how he gets things done step by step in a very methodical manner, all the time giving confidence back to the institutions that were really in danger of being forever tarnished, our intelligence agencies, law enforcement, our medical teams in Washington, D.C. during a global pandemic. I mean, he has put the best people in the best jobs, the most diverse cabinet in the history of the country, more diverse than even Barack Obama's, and he's just accomplished great things. And I want people to see exactly how he did it. And this book is as up-to-date as anything you could read on him.
Again, the name of the book is The Joe Biden Way, How to Become a Bold and Empathetic Leader by Jeffrey Krames. You can order that, well, over at Next Chapter Booksellers in St. Paul or wherever books are sold. Jeffrey, been a fun conversation. Really appreciate your time today and hope folks can go out and check out the book.
Oh, thanks, Brett. You guys are the best. I love you, and I'm going to listen for you.
All right, we'll take a break, and then we'll send things back over to Matt McNeil on AM 950.
Progressive Voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205. I want to give Ryan, a listener who sent me this, credit here. The Republicans have released I guess you could say it is a draft congressional redistricting map. My guess is they couldn't stop self-gratifying as they drew this. Because I don't see any way in the planet this map goes. I just don't. Because it okay. All right. Let me start by saying I want to look at the current map we have. Minneapolis 5, Minnesota 5 is Minneapolis and kind of the first tier suburbs on the west side. St. Paul is Minnesota 4 and goes all the way out to the border with Wisconsin, basically, if you just kind of go straight across. The current Minnesota 3 is basically the rest of Hennepin County, okay? The current Minnesota 3 is basically the rest of Hennepin County. Minnesota 2 currently is the south suburbs, basically just south of Burnsville, stuff like that there in there. Anything south of the river, Lakeville, stuff like that, going on down towards Red Wing, I believe. Minnesota 1 on the southern border, basically, it's every county on the southern border, but then it's on the very western side of the state, it's only those first counties on the southern border. It's Rochester and I believe, is Mankato in there? Yeah, Mankato's in there. And so that's one. 7 is basically the entire western part of the state, you know, from west of St. Cloud out to the borders of the Dakotas. And Minnesota 8, even though it gets down, Chisago County is actually Minnesota 8 currently. And it goes all the way up the Iron Range and basically, yeah, it's not equal. I mean, it does pick up a little bit more of the western part of the state than equal, But it's kind of, you kind of get the idea there. So I want to kind of take what the Republicans have put out here in each individual one and kind of look at what they, what they're changing. And reminder, once again, the problem that they have. Okay, well, first of all, I'm going to say this. Looking at this map, I can't believe their numbers make any damn sense. I can't believe that there'd be equal representation in 4, 5, and 3 with the rest of the state. I really can't, because it seems to me that what they're trying to do is sacrifice 3 to try to pick up 2. And I'll get to that here in a second. But when you look at the redistricting map, 5, Minneapolis, it for the most part stays relatively the same. A few suburbs move out of Minneapolis, but for the most part, 5 stays the same. You know, it's minimal changes here. They had it got smaller. It's getting smaller because, once again, you're dealing with a growing population in the metro area. So that's kind of the problem that the Republicans have. 4, similarly, doesn't change too much. It doesn't nearly go, a lot of the southeastern part of 4 is going to get merged into Minnesota 2. I'll get to that here in a second. But then comes the real, this is their wish list. And this is interesting. Minnesota 3, they basically want to stop it from representing Hennepin County. And it's basically the eastern side of Maple Grove, Plymouth, Minnetonka, maybe a little bit of Southern Lake Minnetonka, but there's a very little bit, you know, right, just as you, you know, kind of going down, just on the very south side, right on the eastern south side there. Hopkins, Bloomington, Eden Prairie, even Burnsville. I mean, Burnsville would be in the third. Invergrove Heights would be in the third. I think Eagan would be in the third if I know my maps correctly. So basically, it becomes a suburban. It becomes a house district, which basically wraps itself around 5 and 3. Which, now I want to step back here and point out something. This clearly shows you the suburbs the Republicans have given up on. That these are the suburbs they've given up on, and they're basically trying to put them all into one district and say, we're done with them. We can't win in Eagan. We can't win in Burnsville. We can't win anymore in Bloomington. We can't win in Eden Prairie. We can't win in Edina. We can't win there. So we're just going to take all these suburbs. We can't win, and you're never going to win in Hopkins. But you're taking all the suburbs. Plymouth, you can't win in Plymouth anymore, which is funny because that was, 4 years ago? That was a Republican seat. But they basically are clearly giving up on all these suburban districts and trying to put them all into one and basically, you know, brutalizing the Minnesota 3rd District at the same time. So that's their plan. They basically just keep all the liberals in those areas. And by the way, to my knowledge on how these redistricting is going to go, that's not going to fly with the House Democrats or the governor, for that matter. So that's not going to be the case. But it is hilarious to watch how, you know, it's a district now that runs from Maple Grove over to Eagan. and so here comes the next switch. So 2, the Minnesota 2nd District, Angie Craig's district, which basically, once again, the problem that they have with the Republicans is that it's into the suburbs, and the suburban vote is basically making that a more Democratic district. So their solution is to basically peel off as much as they can into the 2nd district or into the 3rd district, and then basically kind of then push the district south into more rural parts of the state. This is, like I said, I can't believe the numbers work in this too well, because I got to believe that every Republican district is going to be somewhere in the area, and I'm just eyeballing this right now, somewhere in the area of 100 to 770,000 people less than what the Republican version of 4, 5, and 6 would be. Or excuse me, 4, 5, and 6, 3, 4, and 5, 3, 4, and 5. I'm going to guess that so that the District 4, District 5, and District 6 will be at the maximum level for each district, and then the other 5 districts will be at the minimal level so they can try to spread the Republican vote as far as possible. So Angie Craig then would take over the western part of Hennepin County. She'd actually take Lake Minnetonka. Most of Lake Minnetonka would be in her district. Waconia would be in her district, which currently I believe is in 6, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, I think that's in 6. And so, yeah, clearly it's an attempt to basically get rid of the Republic or the Democratic suburbs that are there. I mean, they also, I should mention here, it's clear the Republicans are giving up on Woodbury, too. That all these communities, they're not even going to try anymore. That they're just basically going to just shovel those into Democratic districts and try to keep the rest of it there. The real big thing, and this is an interesting strategy. So where they're trying to, and this is, by the way, why I don't think these numbers work, is because the 6, they're going to give St. Cloud to Minnesota 7. And so that's the idea, is to give St. Cloud to Minnesota 7 so they increase their population, which means then Minnesota 8 and Minnesota 1 can gobble up parts of 7. That's how they'll expand their population. That's the biggest, first huge red flag, is that I don't see how in the world Minnesota 6 is going to be anywhere close to the same population as any of the other districts. It looks like it's insanely less populated, not just kind of less populated. And that's the whole goal, is you got to make maps. Each congressional district has to have basically the same amount of people in it per district. So the Republicans' plan is to basically send St. Cloud out into the Minnesota 7. Then Minnesota 1 would be able to take up a good chunk of, say, like the bottom 3 tiers of county across the entire southern part of the state. Minnesota 8 would be able to take like good chunk of Lake of the Woods right now is the new district the 8 would go over to Lake of the Woods. It looks like it'd pick up Bemidji, would be part of that. I think Bemidji currently right now is in the 7. And then it would still go down to Chisago. It doesn't seem to make the numbers probably don't make any sense, if you want to know the truth. I'm looking at this map and I just say, A, the numbers don't make any sense. B, you're not going to get a court to sign off on a redistricting where you take the third district and change it so dramatically. I mean, forget about the laughable nature. I can see Melissa Hortman and the House leaders. I can see Governor Walz laughing and laughing and laughing at this map. But forget about them for a second. You're going to have to get this probably through a court, and I would love to see which court in the planet is going to say, oh, yeah, the Minnesota 3rd, which used to be Hennepin County, oh, yeah, we're going to just let them be like a handful of counties, you know, suburbs in Hennepin County, and it's going to pick up all the southern part of the metro. That's not how this works. That's what it is. I mean, six can't possibly be the same amount of people. It just can't possibly be. I mean, you're giving and because you're giving up St. Cloud. I mean, that's a ton of people, and he seems to be giving up some of Minnesota 6 to the 2nd district to try to make that Republican as possible. But he's not picking up too much more north of that. I can't see how this is going to work. I would say this. I think 6 becomes much more playable as far as a district possibly for the Democrats. Because, once again, you're losing St. Cloud. It still has a good chunk of those far-righto loonball suburbs out in the 94 strip that are, you know, righty McRighty pants. And it does look like a chunk of Wright County. Yeah, it looks like a chunk of Wright County still. But he loses St. Cloud, and he still has, especially the suburbs right on the north side. He'd have the other part of Maple Grove. He'd have, Anoka runs a little bit higher there. There you go. Anoka runs a little bit, more red there. But, I don't know, 6 becomes more playable for the Democrats. This is a pipe dream. That's all this is. That's a pipe dream. And you're not going to be able to, in my mind, I got it. What would be the population total of six? Is it listed? It's not. Oh, wow. This is, I will post this image up just for laughability, because there's no way on the planet six is going to be equitable as far as population size. And I know that there are Republicans out there right now who are making the argument that what they're saying is that these outlying districts, because the rural people don't get enough of a message, need to be much smaller than the Twin Cities metro area districts. No judge in the land is going to go with that either. I could see seven making it, eight making it. I just can't see six being anywhere close. I can't believe one would be close too, because it's going to have to give up a good chunk of one to give into the second district so that they can basically try to turn that right. No, I think this is a pipe dream. And like I said, it's dead on arrival at the Democrats, because there's no way on the planet the Democrats are going to say, oh, yeah, sure, let's just put all the Democratic suburbs that you guys can't win in one big district. Okay, done. Nope. It's not how it works. It's not how, especially a district that has nothing to do with that. Jake is in St. Francis, wanted to chime in on something. Welcome on in, Jake.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Sorry to digress. I'm going back to earlier when I was listening and you were talking about kids getting enough sleep.
Yes.
I was actually, I'm on the school board up here in St. Francis, and I was surprised. A lot of the things that are brought to us, some are brought by parents, but some of the stuff like this is actually brought by the educators and then the administration. They know a lot about what's going on, and I see our public up here would be, you know, concerned because of, like you said, the start times. And also, I agree with you. It's important to, you know, be a parent. Tell your kid to go to bed. They need to get sleep when they're young, you know, young like this. And I don't know. I completely agree. The fact that, you know, the start time really doesn't have much to do with it. And it might actually be more disruptive.
I have yet to have a parent who is for this moving later, start times later. When I say to them, well, what about getting kids to go to bed early? Well, I'll tell you what, we got to take a break here. David, why are we playing the end of the show? It's got about 12 minutes left. Okay. All right, forgive me about that, Jake. But no, my point being that
David needs some more sleep.
David, I would not disagree with that. Thanks, Jake. I'll tell you what. Let's take a commercial break, David, all right? 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. The point I was trying to make with the caller there is just this, is that I know a lot of parents that will say, oh, they need more sleep, they'll do this, and I'll look at them and say, well, why don't you just have them go to bed early? And they'll say, well, it's hard, I don't want to be that kind of parent. I was like, but you're the parent, why don't you just have them go to bed early? And at the end of the day, they don't have an answer for that. And I understand people don't want to be buzzkills and don't want to be the non-cool parent, but I got news for you. Parents are not supposed to be cool. Parents are supposed to be parents, and that's kind of the mentality. And so I see a lot of, and I understand people, they fall in love with an idea, but the reality is if you have a problem with kids not getting enough sleep, well, have them go to bed earlier. It's just, and I don't want to do that. I'll be a mean parent. Well, no, it's not being a mean parent. It's being a parent. It's being concerned, making sure your kid's taking care of themselves. That's my point. Speaking of schools, a former middle school principal filed a suit against the Marshall Public School District Board on Wednesday, accusing the board of discrimination and retaliation for her refusal to remove an LGBTQ pride flag from a display at the school cafeteria last year. In her lawsuit, Mary Kay Thomas, who accuses school board director Bill Swope of sexual harassment, claiming he routinely called Thomas sweetie, remarked on her appearance and said he wanted to kiss her neck. The complaint filed with the U.S. District Court in Minneapolis alleges that at one point in their 15-year work relationship, Swope kissed her against her will. Swope is a founder of the Living World Lutheran Church in Marshall, former principal of the Marshall Elementary School, a retired teacher and former executive director of Pride and the Tiger Foundation that raises money for local education. He did not return messages asking for comment. Gizzy. District Superintendent Jeremy Williams, also named in the complaint, said in the statement, Marshall Public Schools is committed to the education of every child and the strong policies and practices in place against discrimination against both students and staff members. The school district is committed to creating a respectful, inclusive, and safe learning and working environment for students and staff. Objections to Thomas's work as principal began when she began advocating for an inclusion project that included LGBTQ pride flag hanging alongside the flag for representing students of other cultural and national identities. If you do read this story up, and I'll post it, it's from Minnesota Reformer. It does seem like something fishy is going on here. That they're you know, this is a person who was getting good reviews, was getting, you know, good work reviews and stuff like that, and basically at, you know, all of a sudden was, you know, shipped around and basically put into a position that was created for her that wasn't principal, and then basically with no long-term job security. And so it seems like there are some issues. As far as the sexual harassment stuff, he kissed you unwantingly. Yikes. Anyway, I'll post the story. This is not going to be one that goes away. And my guess is that they're going to, you know, the school is going to fight this. But if she's got evidence of this going and they can't explain exactly why they shifted her around into different positions, she's going to win. She will win easily, too. All right, so I have healed enough, Patrick. I have healed enough. The hip is back. Yes, there you go. Hip sway. The honey thief takes us out. Have a wonderful weekend. We're back on a Monday. Till then, see ya.
Honeysuckle.